When we at last reached the Valley of the Tomb, the golden coffin was placed beneath a tabernacle outside the entrance to the royal mausoleum. The linen roof of the tent was illuminated with texts and illustrations from the Book of the Dead. There were to be two separate funerals. The first was the lesser, that of the Great Lion of Egypt. The second would be the grander and more elaborate royal funeral. So it was that 3 days after our arrival at the valley, the wooden coffin was placed in the tomb that I had prepared for Tanus, and the tomb was consecrated by the priests of Horus, who was Tanus' patron, and then sealed. During this ritual, my mistress was able to restrain her grief, and to show nothing more than the decent sorrow of a queen towards a faithful servant, although I knew that inside her something was dying that would never be reborn. All that night, the valley resounded to the chant of the Shilluk regiment, as they mourned for the man who had now become one of their gods. To this day they still shout his name in battle. 10 days after the first funeral, the golden coffin was placed on its wooden sledge and dragged into the vast royal tomb. It required the efforts of 300 slaves to manoeuvre the coffin through the passageways. I had designed the tomb so precisely that there was only the breadth of a hand between the sides and the lid of the coffin and the stone walls and roof. To thwart all future grave robbers and any others who would desecrate the royal tomb, I had built a labyrinth of tunnels beneath the mountain. From the entrance in the cliff face, a wide passage led directly to an impressive burial vault that was decorated with marvellous murals. In the centre of this room stood an empty granite sarcophagus, with the lid removed and cast dramatically aside. The first grave robber to enter here would believe that he was too late, and that some other had plundered the tomb before him. In fact, there was another tunnel leading off at right angles from the entrance passage. The mouth of this was disguised as a storeroom for the funerary treasure. The coffin had to be turned and eased into the secondary passage. From there it entered a maze of false passages and dummy burial vaults, each more serpentine and devious than the last. In all, there were 4 burial chambers, but 3 of these would remain forever empty. There were 3 hidden doors and 2 vertical shafts. The coffin had to be lifted up one of these and lowered down the other. It took 15 days for the coffin to be inched through this maze and installed at last in its final resting place. The roof and walls of this tomb were painted with all the skill and genius with which the gods have gifted me. There was not a space the size of my thumbnail that was not blazing with colour and movement. 5 storerooms led off from the chamber. Into these were packed that treasure which Pharaoh Mimosa had accumulated over his lifetime, and which had come close to beggaring our very Egypt. I had argued with my mistress that instead of being buried in the earth, this treasure should be used to pay for the army and the struggle that lay ahead of us in our efforts to expel the Hyksos tyrant and to liberate our people and our land. "The treasure belongs to Pharaoh," she had replied. "We have built up another treasure of gold and slaves and ivory here in Cush. That will suffice. Let the divine Mimosa have what is his. I have given him my oath on it." Thus, on the 15th day, the golden coffin was placed within the stone sarcophagus that had been hewn out of the native rock. With a system of ropes and levers, the heavy lid was lifted over it and lowered into place. The royal family and the priests and the nobles entered the tomb to perform the last rites. My mistress and the prince stood at the head of the sarcophagus, and the priests droned on with their incantations and their readings from the Book of the Dead. The sooty smoke from the lamps and the breathing of the throng of people in the confined space soured the air, so it was soon difficult to breathe. In the dim yellow light I saw my mistress turn pale and the perspiration bead on her forehead. I worked my way through the tightly packed ranks, and I reached her side just as she swayed and collapsed. I was able to catch her before she struck her head on the granite edge of the sarcophagus. We carried her out of the tomb on a litter. In the fresh mountain air she recovered swiftly. But still I confined her to her bed in her tent for the rest of that day. That night, as I prepared her a tonic of herbs, she lay quietly and thoughtfully, and after she had drunk the infusion, she whispered to me, "I had the most extraordinary sensation. As I stood in Pharaoh's tomb, I felt suddenly that Tanus was very close to me. I felt his hand touch my face and his voice murmur in my ear. That was when I fainted away." He will always be close to you, I told her. I believe that, she said simply. I can see now, though I could not see it then, that her decline began on the day that we laid Thanos in his grave. She had lost the joy of living and the will to go on. I went back into the royal tomb the next day with the masons and the corps of slave labourers to seal the doorways and the shafts and to arm the devices that would guard the burial chamber. As we retreated through the maze of passageways, we blocked the secret doorways with cunningly laid stone and plaster and painted murals over them. We sealed the mouths of the vertical shafts so that they appeared to be smooth floor and roof. I set rock falls that would be triggered by a footstep on a loose paving slab, and I packed the vertical shafts with balks of timber. As these decayed over the centuries and the fungus devoured them, they would emit noxious vapours that would suffocate any intruder who succeeded in finding his way through the secret doorways. But before we did all this, I went to the actual burial chamber to take leave of Thanos. I carried with me a long bundle wrapped in a linen sheet. When I stood for the last time beside the royal sarcophagus, I sent all the workmen away. I would be the very last to leave the tomb, and after me the entrance would be sealed. When I was alone, I opened the bundle I carried. From it I took the longbow Lanuta. Thanos had named it after my mistress, and I had made it for him. It was a last gift from the two of us. I placed it upon the sealed stone lid of his coffin. There was one other item in my bundle. It was the wooden Ushabti figure that I had carved. I placed it at the foot of the sarcophagus. While I carved it, I had set up three copper mirrors so that I could study my own features from every angle and reproduce them faithfully. The doll was a miniature Taita. Upon the base I had inscribed the words, "My name is Taita. I am a physician and a poet. I am an architect and a philosopher. I am your friend. I will answer for you." As I left the tomb, I paused at the entrance and looked back for the last time. "Farewell, old friend," I said. "I am richer for having known you. Wait for us on the other side." It took me many months to complete the work on the royal tomb. As we retreated through the labyrinth, I personally inspected every sealed doorway and every secret device that we left behind us. I was alone, for my mistress and the prince had gone up into the mountains to the fortress of Prester Beni John. They had gone with all the court to prepare for the wedding of Memnon and Messara. Huey had accompanied them to select the horses from the Ethiopian herds that were part of our payment for the storming of Adbar Seged and the recovery of Massara. When at last my work in the tomb was completed and my workmen had sealed the outer entrance in the cliff face, I also set off into the mountains over those cold and windy passes. I was anxious not to miss the wedding feast, but I had left it late. The completion of the tomb had taken longer than I had planned. I travelled as hard as the horses could stand. I reached Prester Beni John's palace 5 days before the wedding, and I went directly to that part of the fortress where my mistress and her suite were lodged. "I have not smiled since last I saw you, Taita," she greeted me. "Sing for me, tell me your stories, make me laugh." It was not an easy task she set me, for the melancholy had entered deeply into her soul, and the truth was that I was not myself cheerful or light-hearted. I sensed that more than sorrow alone was affecting her. Soon we abandoned our attempts at merriment and fell to discussing affairs of state. It might have been a love match and a meeting of twin souls blessed by the gods as far as the two lovers were concerned, but for the rest of us, the joining of Memnon and Messara was a royal wedding and a contract between nations. There were agreements and treaties to negotiate, dowries to decide, trade agreements to draw up between the King of Kings and ruler of Aksum and the regent of Egypt and the wearer of the double crown of the two kingdoms. As I had predicted, my mistress had been at first less than enchanted by the prospect of her only son marrying a woman of a different race. "In all things they are different, Taita. The gods they worship, the language they speak, the colour of their skins. Oh, I wish he had chosen a girl of our own people." "He will," I reassured her. "He will marry 50, perhaps 100 Egyptians. He will also marry Libyans and Hurrians and Hyksos. All the races and nations he conquers in the years to come will provide him with wives, Cushites and Hittites and Assyrians. Stop your teasing, Taita. She stamped her foot with something of her old fire. You know full well what I mean. Those others will all be marriages of state. This, his first, is a marriage of two hearts. What she said was true. The promise of love that Memnon and Massara had exchanged in those fleeting moments beside the river was now blossoming. I was especially privileged to be close to them in these heady days. They both acknowledged and were grateful for my part in bringing them together. I was for both of them a friend of long standing, somebody that they trusted without question. I did not share my mistress's misgivings, though they were different in every way that she had listed. Their hearts were turned from the same mould. They both possessed a sense of dedication, a fierceness of the spirit, a touch of the ruthlessness and the cruelty that a ruler must have. They were a matched pair, he the Tirsal and she the Falcon. I knew that she would not distract him from his beauty, but rather that she would encourage and incite him to greater endeavour. I was content with my efforts as a matchmaker. One bright mountain day, watched by 20,000 men and women of Ethiopia and of Egypt, who crowded the slopes of the hills around them, Memnon and Massara stood together on the river bank and broke the jar of water that the high priest of Osiris had scooped from the infant Nile. The bride and the groom led our caravan down from the mountains, laden with the dowry of a princess and the treaties and the protocols of kinship sealed between our two nations. Huey and his grooms drove a herd of 5,000 horses behind us. Some of these were in payment for our mercenary services, and the rest made up Massara's dowry. However, before we reached the junction of the two rivers at Kibui, we saw the dark stain on the plains ahead, as though a cloud had cast its shadow over the savannah. But the sun shone out of a cloudless sky. The Gnu herds had returned on their annual migration. Within weeks of this contact with the Gnu, the yellow strangler disease fell upon our herd of Ethiopian horses, and it swept through them like a flash flood in one of the valleys of the high mountains. Naturally, Huey and I had been expecting the plague to strike when the Gnu returned, and we had made our preparations. We had trained every groom and charioteer to perform the tracheotomy, and to treat the wound with hot pitch to prevent mortification until the animal had a chance to recover from the strangler. For many weeks, none of us enjoyed much sleep, but in the end, fewer than 2,000 of our new horses died of the disease, and before the next flooding of the Nile, those that survived were strong enough to begin training in the chariot traces. When the floods came, the priests sacrificed on the banks of the river, each to his own god, and they consulted the auguries for the year ahead. Some consulted the entrails of the sacrificial sheep, others watched the flight of the wild birds, still others stared into vessels filled with water from the Nile. They divined in their separate ways. Queen Lostris sacrificed to Hapi. Although I attended the service with her and joined in the liturgy and the responses of the congregation, my heart was elsewhere. I am a Horus man, and so are Lord Kratos and Prince Memnon. We made a sacrifice of gold and ivory to our god and prayed for guidance.